Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
So on a normal summer, lots of people flee to dangerous destinations that aren't just tourist spots. Maybe they have meaning in their lives. Maybe you went to the Jersey Shore as a kid and now you're taking your kids. Perhaps you love a good hike in the Catskills and then a dip in the Esopus. Maybe your parents or grandparents retired to Cape Cod and they get you as a visitor every summer. Thanks to the coronavirus, everything looks and feels different this year, but many New Yorkers have kept their summer traditions going. In fact, some even got a head start and left town in March and April, and they've not come back just yet. For me and my family, that place is Martha's Vineyard. My family's been coming here for 60 years, no kidding. Get this, guys. My dad bought a house here in the 60s for $8,000. Seriously, $8,000. I spent every summer here as a kid because my mom was a school teacher. And now my sister lives here full time. My uncle is here. I have longtime friends. I have summer family. My parents are actually laid to rest here. So that's why I'm here with my kid for the next couple of weeks. So you say Martha's Vineyard to some people and they think a black dog on a t-shirt, right? Or some people think whale pants and rich people. Some people think Native American culture. Some people think low-key celebrities and visual artists. Some think hippies. Some think African-American pioneers. Some people think hardcore fishing. The truth is, it's all of the above. So as long as I'm here for a bit, we thought we'd dive into the history of Martha's Vineyard. Joining me is Thomas Dresser. He's written several books about the vineyard, and his latest is called The Rise of Tourism on Martha's Vineyard. Thomas, welcome.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
So happy to have you. So listeners, we want to hear from you. What's your family's summer tradition? Is it going to a favorite vacation spot in the Catskills or Long Island, somewhere in New England? Maybe you head to Coney Island every year with the fam, or Brighton Beach, or you're visiting families in another part of the country. Maybe it's something as simple as a big old family cookout. Are you able to continue the tradition this year? Are you starting a new summer tradition? We want to hear from you. 646-435-7280. That's 646-435-7280. You can also tweet to us at @allofitwnyc. Or if you want to remain anonymous and you don't feel like being on the radio, just leave us a message on Instagram. We use the same handle, @allofitwnyc. So let's do a little bit of a history lesson first, Thomas, about Martha's Vineyard. Let's start with the original inhabitants of the island who are still very active today, the Wampanoag. Tell us a little bit about the Wampanoag and what the original name of the island was.
All right. Well, we have to jump back about 10,000 years in our history. Before we became an island, we were attached to Cape Cod, and the Native Americans, the Wampanoag, were settled on Cape Cod and down along the Vineyard shore. And then about 4,000 years ago, the glaciers melted and the oceans rose, and Martha's Vineyard became an island. So they are the original natives of Martha's Vineyard. Now, they called this place Nopi, or Noepi, which means amid the waters, and that's a perfect definition of an island. And part of their history is dependent on a legendary ancestor named Moshup. And Moshup was living in what we now know as Cape Cod, but it started to get too crowded for him. And he got up and he plodded through the waters and came to what became Nopi. And that's how we began, as far as the Native Americans conceive the original story. They are here today. There are about 1,000 or 1,200 members of the Wampanoag tribe, but a good number of them live over on the mainland, which we call America. So that gives you a little background on where the Native Americans came from. There's still about 300 or 400 that live on the vineyard. There's intermarriage with the whites and the African Americans, but there's also a real population of the Native Americans. They're a recognized tribe. They've been recognized since 1987 by the federal government. and they are part of the community. A great number of them settled in Gay Head, which is the southwest corner of the island, and some of them have little gift shops that are right by the Gay Head Cliffs, and that's one of the sightseeing places that the white people, that visitors have been going to for 150 years. So yeah. That sort of sets the tone for the background of tourism on Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, my neighbors on one side are Wampanoag. They're part of the tribe. And your place you're talking about, Gay Head, it's now called Aquinnah. If you've been coming here for a long time, people sort of use them interchangeably. You mentioned these cliffs and how people love to go. They flock to the cliffs. What is special about the Aquinnah Cliffs and the lighthouse?
Well, the lighthouse has been there since the 1850s and as a brick structure. Before that, it was a wooden structure that was ordered in place in 1799 by President John Adams. But it really became a landmark in the 1850s, and it guards Vineyard Sound with the ships that are traveling from New York to Boston. That was the primary means of transport in the 19th century. So the lighthouse is sort of a figurehead of the southwest corner of the island. The Gay Head Cliffs themselves go back hundreds of thousands of years. They are 150 feet above the ocean. They are eroding into the ocean. They are made of clay, or there's a good amount of clay there, and the Native Americans are the only ones that are allowed to use that clay to make pottery. But the sites are there for people to see, and you're sort of at a headland looking out to sea, and you're looking off toward Rhode Island and southeastern Massachusetts when you are out on the cliffs. It's high, it's overlooking the ocean, it's scenic. There's little shops there, there's the lighthouse there. But if you had come 150 years ago or 130 years ago, you would have come from down in Oak Bluffs and taken a steamship. And the steamship was like a day trip for vacationers who came to Oak Bluffs, and then they would take the steamship out to Gay Head. And this would be a one-day trip that would take them out, 12, 15 miles along the shore, and they would get out of the steamship in Gay Head. They would climb aboard a little ox cart, and the ox cart would be led by Native Americans, and they would be taken to lighthouse. They would be shown the Gay Head Cliffs, and then they could buy small tokens or pottery that the Native Americans made. So it was sort of a blending of the original natives of the island with the tourist trade that was growing by leaps and bounds in the late 1800s.
My guest is Thomas Dresser. The name of his new book is The Rise of Tourism on Martha's Vineyard. We got a tweet from Elizabeth and a picture she sent. I've been going to Martha's Vineyard since 1986. We stayed in the same house I did as a child and celebrate my daughter's birthday there every year. We masked up and kept the tradition going. I couldn't cancel her favorite thing. It was great. It's a very funny picture of her and her child. Someone's attempting a handstand in Ocean Park in this picture.
Wow.
Let's go to
That's
us.
Great.
Let's go to Stephanie online, too. Her family has a tradition at a different island. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. Thank you so much for talking about this great topic. Yeah, my parents bought a little house in the 50s. I was born in the 60s. I'm one of five children. And we spent summers on a sandbar, Fire Island, a little community called Davis Park in New York. And it was like a different universe. Everything has changed, but I wouldn't trade those memories for anything.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. We really appreciate it. As I said, my guest is Thomas Dresser. He's talking about the rise of tourism on Martha's Vineyard, especially since you're stuck with me up here for a while, Thomas. Something I think is really interesting is people maybe think, I've never heard of the Wampanoag, but anybody who had a literature class and read Moby Dick, the harpooner Tashtego was Wampanoag from the island. Which brings
That's
me to
right.
the subject of whaling. Whaling was huge in this part of the world. What was special about whaling around Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket, too? We'll throw Nantucket a bone.
Well, whaling was the primary economic engine for about 150 years, from 1750 to 1900. And there were three primary ports, Massachusetts ports, that were whaling capitals: Nantucket, where a lot of the money was and a lot of the ships sailed out of, New Bedford, which is where the many of the whaling ships sent their oil to be part of, to be shipped across the mainland, and then Martha's Vineyard. And Martha's Vineyard was known for its crew. We provided most of the crew, or many of the crew, for the whaling ships, and it was really a very popular and prosperous business for decades. And it was not an easy job. It was a very lonely, male-oriented, isolated, either you were very bored or you were working your tail off in a challenging economic situation. And the sort of the downside is that there were times when the captain was very demanding and overreaching, and you didn't have any place where you could go. There was no one that could help you out of the situation. You really had to deal with a rugged captain. So a great number of the people who signed up for whaling only went on one trip. One was enough. And but the money that was made was, comparable to what people in the high end of our economic world make today. But back then in the 1800s, very different. So
I know,
that's a little bit of whaling. It died out when the whales died out, And also with the onset of electricity, because most of the whale oil was used for lighting purposes. And the oceans, the Atlantic, Pacific, and the Arctic, were overfished, and it just became no longer an economic opportunity for people.
Our number 646.
So once whaling started to die out, The people on Martha's Vineyard sought another economic opportunity, and tourism really blossomed in the mid-19th century, just as whaling was starting to die out.
Let's talk about that in just a minute. I do want to give our phone number out again, 646-435-7200. Do you have a favorite family tradition in the summer, someplace that you always go, someplace that you wouldn't miss? Maybe you come to New England, the Catskills. Maybe it's right in New York City. Maybe there's something you do right in the city, Brighton Beach, Coney Island. Maybe it's just a summer barbecue in the park. We'd love to hear from you, your family tradition, 646-435-7280. Or you can tweet to us at All of It WNYC, or if you want to send us a message on Instagram, at All of It WNYC. We're looking at family traditions today in the summer. My guest is Thomas Dresser. He's talking about the rise of tourism on Martha's Vineyard. Before we talk about tourism, I do want to go to Catherine on line one real quick. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi, Allison. How are you? When I heard this, I just got so excited. I said, oh, my God, can I find that piece of paper that talks about John Folger, the ancestor of my grandmother, who came from Norwich, Norfolk, England, and settled on Martha's Vineyard in 1635.
Wow.
Or 1636, rather. Wow. And John Folger's wife's maiden name was Mariba Gibbs, G-I-B-B-S. And he died on the vineyard in either 1661 or 1662, and then his widow died in 1666. And through them, I'm distantly related to Benjamin Franklin.
So
So my cousin and I went there in the 90s, and we looked for all the old graves and stuff, and it was great fun.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for sharing that story. That's interesting, Thomas. If you are a history buff on this island, you can find some amazing headstones. Amazing.
Oh, right. I've done a couple of cemetery tours, and it's fascinating to do the research for them, because we do have a population that's quite varied and from different parts of the world. But I'm very interested in this this last caller's comment that John Folger came to the vineyard in 1636 because our typical history says that the vineyard was first settled by white men in 1642 by Thomas Mayhew. So if she wants to get in touch with me, I'd love to, you know, find out more information. But I guess I could find out his gravestone if he's buried here. So that's an interesting sidelight. But right, there is tons of history, and as you mentioned at the top of the story, I've written a number of books. I started with a murder mystery. I've done a shipwreck story. I've written about African Americans, Native Americans, and then we get into tourism. And it's sort of ironic. I thought it was ironic that I'm writing a book about tourism on the worst possible time of our life, that tourism is, you know, down the tubes. And yet, it's sort of a virtual escape. I mean, the people that are calling in today are so excited to talk about Martha's Vineyard, even if they're not there. So, you know, you can have a virtual escape by thinking or reading or discussing Martha's Vineyard. So maybe this is a sort of a hidden gem, that there's a book about tourism on Martha's Vineyard that so many people can relate to.
Yeah, we got a tweet from Molly. Yeah. My husband and I got married at the sailing camp in Oak Bluff 6 years ago and just missed being in the middle of a hurricane. We have such a soft spot for the island and really miss being able to go this year. We're going to continue my conversation with Thomas Dresser, author of The Rise of Tourism on Martha's Vineyard, after the break. And we want to hear about your family traditions as well. 646-435-7280. We'll be right back after a quick break. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest is Thomas Dresser, The Rise of Tourism on Martha's Vineyard. In your book, you write, early on, the vineyard earned a reputation as a welcoming place to outsiders. How so?
Well, just the way I started my research on tourism is I walked a mile down the street to the Methodist campground, which was formed in the 1830s. By a group of Methodists who wanted to set off a summer retreat. And it was a couple of vineyarders were part of that, but there were a great many people who came from southeastern New England and journeyed across the water to our little escape place on the shore. Some of you know about Ocean Grove, New Jersey, up in New York, there's Round Lake, there's a place in Maine, there's a place in Pennsylvania. These are all Methodist campgrounds that were started in the mid-1800s. Part of the Methodist creed was to go and support the indigent, the poor, the slaves, the immigrants, anyone who was sort of off the main scale of things, the Methodists were supporting them. So just by their nature, the campground meeting on Martha's Vineyard invited and welcomed the middle class, the lower class, and sort of outsiders to come here. So the Methodist campground got started in 1835 and blossomed by the era of the Civil War. There were as many as 320 families coming each year for a week just to pray, to eat communally, to sing together, and to listen to their preachers preach. Now, for those first 20 years, people just came and they pitched tents and they stayed in the campground. They didn't go in the ocean. They didn't go shopping. They didn't eat out at fancy restaurants. They basically stayed right in their little camp area. Then, just before the Civil War, they started to build these little cabins, and more than 500 of these little cottages were constructed in the Methodist campground, and a good number of them are still extant today. And the people I've talked to, and I visited Ocean Grove, say that the campground at Martha's Vineyard is comparable, similar to what you see at Ocean Grove, except ours has focused primarily or exclusively on the little cottages. We don't have the tents anymore. But the Methodist thing got things started. Then in 1866, this fellow came to Martha's Vineyard named Erastus Carpenter, and he started the first residential community in the United States, the original Levittown, if you will. And he bought up 75 acres of land right next to the campground. And he was not a Methodist, and he didn't support what the Methodists were doing. He wanted to replicate it without the religious ingredient. And so he sold off 1,000 house lots to middle-class people who he encouraged to come down to the vineyard and have a vacation retreat. And this was 1866, 3 years before the place that Frederick Law Olmsted started in Chicago. And this planned community had winding streets, and it had parks, and he had a steamship pier, and there was a great big hotel, and he had a winding street that ran around the whole area called Circuit Avenue. And he sold out the house in about a dozen years. He started something called Illumination Night, which is where the little cabins in the campground, as well as his Oak Bluffs Land and Wharf Company, they held Japanese lanterns in the porches on the last day of the season or the last day of the religious retreat, depending on how you looked at it.
And it's one
so
of those beautiful nights.
So that welcomed a whole different class, and it broadened the view of tourism.
And the thing about illumination is it still happens to this day, and it's one of the most magical experiences ever.
Right, except this year we're not having it, along with no fireworks and no ag fair.
Yeah, so. It's a little like old school vineyard, though. Let's go to, I'm one of these people, like, I'm trying to look at the glasses half full here. Let's go to Deborah on line six, who says she has a great story about the campgrounds. Hi,
hi.
Deborah.
Hi, Allison. Actually, this is Debbie Guarino. We met.
Oh, hi, Debbie.
I'm a children's author. Hi. You know I'm a children's author, and I took my sons, Josh and Daniel, there many years ago when they were little. And one of the things I like best about Martha's Vineyard in general was that you're not allowed to bring cars over, and we got around by bicycle. And at the time, Daniel was so young, I was, you know, putting him in one of those little carts. But when someone on the island heard that I was a children's author, they said, well, you should go to the campground because Shel Silverstein lives here part-time. And he was somebody I idolized and had always wanted to meet. So we pedaled on over, and I love the campground. Unfortunately, when I got outside the cottage where I thought he lived, and it looked like he did, because on the porch was a stack of books with his glasses and a pen that looked like he'd been signing books, I suddenly heard from inside a very loud confrontation he was having with someone over the phone.
Oh, no.
And I thought, I don't think this is a good time to just knock on his door and say hi. So I regretted not doing it ever since, because unfortunately he passed away the next year.
Oh.
So I never did get to meet him. But the other great thing about Martha's Vineyard was I had written a manuscript which was about seagulls, and I won't go into the plot, but the point was is that I was trying to look for something that would represent seagulls, and I came up with this idea that they had a flag in a inland state. Now, I never knew that seagulls were the national bird of, or sorry, the official bird of Utah until I went into a cottage in Martha's Vineyard, and there in a handmade quilt were all the states of the Union and each bird representing that state, and it was a seagull.
Who knew?
Of Utah.
Oh.
And, because they apparently, they rescued Utah from an invasion of locusts. It was supposed to be one of God's miracles.
Wow. Deborah, thank you so much for calling in. We're going to try to get to some other calls. Let's go to line four. James is calling us from Queens. Hi, James. Thanks for calling all of it.
Hey, thank you for having me. Me and my family, we would go up to Bar Harbor, Maine, which is a little bit difficult to get to, but a really beautiful place if you can ever get up there, to Cadillac Mountain in Acadia National Park. It's the easternmost part of the United States on the seaboard, and so if you go to the top of the mountain, it's the first place you can see the sunrise in the United States every morning. Additionally, it's got really beautiful vegetation because there was a fire, I don't remember how many years back, 100 something years ago, that wiped out half of the vegetation on the island. So all of this beautiful plant life has really come to Mount Desert Isle and the Bar Harbor area, which is a really beautiful place to go.
Love it. Thanks so much for calling, James. Myla from Twitter says, my family and I spend summers in Normandy, France. My husband is French and wanted to share his culture with our kids. We're not doing that this year, but we will be in Cape Cod for the summer. Let's go to line three and Ashley. Hi, Ashley. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi. My family goes to a town in central Mexico called San Miguel de Allende, and we've been going since 1989. And I was telling the screener that the last time we were together, we were there, which was in March. Yeah. And then, you know, we all kind of, the rest of my family lives in Texas and in Arkansas, and they, you know, we've all been isolated since then. And so my wife and I just bought a house in Springs on the eastern end of Long Island. So we're like, oh, you can come up this summer since we won't go to Mexico. But of course, since they're in Arkansas and Texas, they haven't been able to come up. So, you know, we look forward to the future.
Looking forward. Thank you for sharing your family story, though, as well. Let's see, on line two, is Molly still there?
I'm here.
Hey, Molly, thanks for calling All of It. You're on the air.
Hi. It's good to be here. It's funny that you mentioned Illumination Night and the fireworks, because my husband and I you heard my tweet a few minutes ago. My husband and I got married there 6 years ago. And it was actually on July 4th, and that year, a hurricane almost hit the island, and we didn't even have the fireworks that year. And we so miss being there, because there's something so special about the people that live there year round. And it is, just like you were talking about with the tourists, it's so welcoming and wonderful. And I'm just going to have to live vicariously through you, because we really, really miss getting back this year.
Well, come on back
anytime
soon.
It's been really fascinating learning about history.
Thanks so much for calling in.
You.
My guest is Thomas Dresser. The Rise of Tourism on Martha's Vineyard is his book. This is so, we've got, our lines are just full, Thomas. Somebody wrote, I remember a dance camp in Martha's Vineyard in 1954. It was run by Kathleen Heaney, which is kind of exciting. This is such a great story. One of the things I want to get to before we run out of time with you, Thomas, is it's really important to note the history of African Americans on the island and why the island is so important to Black families like mine. For example, would you explain what that history is and why it's so important?
Well, if you look just at slavery, that being an island, that we had a number of escaped slaves that found refuge on Martha's Vineyard. So we like to think that we're part of the Underground Railroad, though we don't have an official station. We have a number of tales of slaves that escaped to the vineyard and then were spirited off to New Bedford and on to Canada. Then after the Civil War, a number of white families started to vacation on the vineyard, bringing their black servants. And so the servants were introduced to the beauty of the vineyard. And after 1900, a number of blacks were able to have come down here and buy houses here. There also was a hotel, the Shearer Cottage, opened in 1912. Because there was segregation that hotels would not serve black people or allow black people on board. So the Shearer Cottage started, and it's still going today. And the one point of Shearer that I'm most proud of for them is that a bench that's at the front of Shearer Cottage has been donated to the African American Smithsonian Museum in Washington, and I've been down there to see it. So a little bit of Oak Bluffs has made it to the nation's capital.
Yeah, they had a whole Oak Bluffs.
There was a big starting point with the African American community with the hotels, and then there was a gentleman who came from Jamaica, Oscar Denison, was a minister who worked with immigrants and worked with blacks in Oak Bluffs, and was very inviting and welcoming for 40 years, and that brought more people. Then we had visitors coming here, like Adam Clayton Powell from Harlem came here. Harry Burley, who did a lot of, kept Negro spirituals alive. Ethel Waters was here. We had Harry Belafonte came, Sammy Davis. And then in 1961 and 62, we had Dr. Martin Luther King vacationing on the vineyard. So we've had a tradition. And then, of course, you can't ignore the fact that President Obama vacationed here 7 out of the 8 years that he was president and has bought a house on the vineyard. And the rumor is that he's on the island now and will be playing golf later this week. So, you know, the tradition continues.
For sure. I mean, Valerie Jarrett has a house here. Dr. Gates has a house here. Spike Lee. It's a really interesting community. Before I let you go, I have to play this particular clip of Roy Scheider staring at a shark on a boat. Go for it.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
All right, so Thomas, the modern thing that people, it's not that modern anymore, but Jaws was filmed on the island. It's a big part of the tourism here.
Definitely. Since 1974, when it was filmed, anyone who comes here wants to see where it was filmed. They want to know if I was in the movie. And, you know, there are shark tours, shark contests, and so forth. It still is very much part of our whole ethos here that, you know, living in a dangerous situation with the sharks in the water, well, it used to be such a joke that it was just an artificial shark that was swimming around there. But if you follow the news, there have been two or three shark situations where swimmers have been attacked off of Cape Cod, not on the Vineyard, but it's very close, very nearby. So the stories have to be taken very seriously now. But it is a big thing, and it's part of our tourism today, is that people are still very interested in seeing and hearing and learning more about the whole story of Jaws.
So. My guest has been Thomas Dresser, historian, as you can tell, with such amazing information. His latest book is The Rise of Tourism on Martha's Vineyard. Callers, thank you so much for sharing your family stories. And Thomas, thank you so much for sharing all that history with us.
Very good. It's been a pleasure sharing it, and I love to talk about history. It's just right there. If we know our history, we know where to go forward, how to go forward. So thank you for having me.
Thanks, Thomas.